From UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation, this is Tales from the South.
I am struck suddenly by the image of my grandmother's dentures floating in their little pink cup, glowing beneath the bathroom nightlight.
Recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas.
I slowly looked around the large tour bus taking in all the blue-haired women and balding men. I was the youngest person there by at least 60 years.
Each week, it's an intimate dinner with everyday Southerners on our unrehearsed show, telling their story, as if they were sitting on the porch with you.
Getting Grandma corseted was quite an ordeal. Right now, it lacked 3 inches meeting.
So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
She's everything that a country boy needs. When the kid boy, she's a staring bag of me. When she cats me out, dogs bow wow. But she's everything that a country boy needs. When the kid boy, she's staring bag of me. Thank you, everybody.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's band, the Salty Dogs? What'd y'all think? Y'all like the Salty Dogs? They have CDs for sale after the show, and you can find out more at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And what do y'all think about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight's stories all involve grandmas and the influence they have, for better or worse, on their granddaughters. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Mary Button visits her grandmother and makes a vow to never do something. And we'll end the night with Carla Haney on a bus full of grandmas. But let's start the night with Jennifer Miller as she discovers a truth about her grandmother and herself in Mummies.
A 3-foot-tall bunny is guaranteed to attract attention. My 4-year-old daughter takes gigantic, calculated hops from the front door through the museum's foyer. She stops at the information kiosk where she grabs the counter on the final jump, hanging chin-up style, only her fingertips, bunny ears, and head visible to the volunteer manning the post. "Where's Tutu?" she asks. She does not smile. Her red, glittery shoes flutter midair. "We're here because Emmy wanted to go to Egypt for spring break." My mother suggested a road trip. "It would be like the ones we used to take with my grandmother," she said. "But this time we would see," as Emmy told anyone who would listen, "not just a sarcophagus, but a real live mummy." The woman behind the counter leans in towards Emmy's face. "Tutu is just down the hall. She's going to be excited to see you." "Yep, I think as excited as someone dead for 2,000 plus years could be." Satisfied with this answer, Emmy pushes off the podium. Her landing makes a sharp, cracking sound, more elephant than bunny. She grabs the hand of her new friend and hops across the hall to the exhibit's main entry, where a suit of armor stands guard in front of a bright red wall. At the sight of Tutu, she forgets everything I have told her about how to behave in a museum. She lets go of the woman and breaks into a dead run, skidding to a stop at the case. I flinch as she presses her palms to the glass. When she steps away, a perfect set of prints remain. I'm hanging back, the last of the line, to gaze down at Tutu. I tried to clean up with a handful of baby wipes as we got out of the car, but there are 400 miles between Little Rock, Arkansas, and Tutu's home in Shawnee, Oklahoma, and I'm hot and tired and sticky with animal crackers and cherry limeade. Where are her bones? Emmy asks. Look, the docent points to an x-ray hanging on the wall. Thanks to this picture, we know a few things about Tutu. She was a woman who gave birth to several children. Tutu still has most of her teeth and strong bones. She probably had a very nice life. I ponder this logic. Ownership of original teeth at death equals nice life. I am struck suddenly by the image of my grandmother's dentures floating in their little pink cup, glowing beneath the bathroom nightlight. Whatever happened to those teeth? Were they tagged by the crime lab and then forgotten in an evidence locker? Were they cremated with her body after the autopsy? In the last year of her life, my grandmother refused to leave her triple-wide mobile home. She watched the same two movies, Anna and the King. I like Jodie Foster, she'd say. And Pure Country. But I love George Strait. Over and over again on her DVD player. Was it Alzheimer's? My mother took her to the doctor. Do you know what day it is? He asked. Wednesday, she said. Do you know the year? 2004. Do you know the name of the President of the United States? She glared, silent as the Sphinx. Doctor's ruling? Mild depression. She would get over it. I went to her house a few weeks afterward. The once neat and perky brown and white trailer sagged. Gone were the razor-straight rows of purple and yellow flowers, hyacinth, daylilies, daffodils. All but the most daring bulb had been choked out by weeds. The swan-shaped planters, bought especially for springtime pansies, were dulled and broken, their heads resting next to their bodies on the rotted-out steps that led to the front door. I parked my car and sat staring at the scar of scorched earth that ran the length of her property right up to her neighbor's door. She'd been burning trash and lost control of a fire. She didn't call 911 or run to get help. Instead, she went inside to watch TV. I stood on the back porch, knocking on the glass, sliding doors, and calling her name. I could see piles everywhere, clothes, dishes, trash. When she didn't answer, I let myself inside. I found my grandmother sitting in her chair, clutching her dog, staring at a television that was barely visible between twin towers of junk mail and old newspapers. She acknowledged me with a slight wave when I blocked her view. I stomped into the kitchen. I swore at a swarm of flies. And when my grandmother finally got out of that torn leather chair and came to stand next to me, still holding her little matted dog, I fussed. What is going on? Her vacant look softened into a face I recognized. He's never coming back, is he? She wouldn't say anything else. She just went back to her chair, sat down, and after fiddling with the remote for a few minutes, started her movie over at the beginning. I went home and stripped just inside the front door, tossed my clothes in the garbage can, and in the shower I stood under scalding water trying to remember the last time she'd mentioned him. I was in seventh grade, maybe? We'd taken a road trip to Florida. She and I were sunbathing, lying face down on long, colorful towels. She described lost summers with girlfriends, how they'd filched first aid tape and used it to spell out their boyfriend's names on their skin. We'd get sunburned everywhere except where the tape was, she said. I have pictures. One whole summer, my back said Jim. That was the only time I ever heard her use my grandfather's name. I don't remember our first road trips together, my grandmother, my mother, and me, cruising Interstate 40, playing a grown-up version of I Spy, searching for his car in the parking lot of every grungy motel within a 60-mile radius of their house. I was two when he admitted to the judge he'd been unfaithful, the first time on their wedding night in 1952, and the last being with their marriage counselor a few days prior. That was 1976. He remarried later that year, and his second wife had written a monthly alimony check ever since. A few weeks after the doctor called her depressed, my grandmother didn't show up for Thanksgiving dinner. She was gone, as were her purse, her dog, and her car. My mother called the police, but the officer who answered refused to take a missing persons report. "Don't take it personal," he told her. "It happens this time of year. The holidays, people take off. They don't want to see their families. But she'll show up." The first weekend of December, a farmer out making his morning rounds in Lamar, a town 91 miles from my grandmother's house, noticed a blue Chevy Cavalier had been run into a ditch on the edge of his land. A small white dog yipped and snarled when he came near the window. The doors were locked, and the keys were in the ignition. He noticed a woman lying about 50 feet from the car. She was curled up next to a tree with her arm lying over it. He thought she was asleep until he saw her teeth lying beside her. Later, after the autopsy determined my grandmother's death accidental, due to exposure to the elements, I asked my mother, "Do you think she did it on purpose?" My mother stared past me. The vacant look is evidently hereditary. Now, in the museum, I am staring at Tutu's jaw on the X-ray. I was about Emmy's age when I first asked my grandmother what happened to her teeth. "Well," she said, "they were bad. I told the dentist to pull them and give me dentures, and he wouldn't do it. He said he could fix the ones I had. So I waited till they got to the point where he didn't have a choice." I went back and said, "You're going to have to give me those teeth now." She paused and smiled, giving me a good look at her hard-won prize before she finished. He didn't like it one bit, but he had to do just what I said. That was my Aunt Beverly, proud to be from the Show Me State, the place her father had come to from Nebraska to farm and raise a family. They found him one winter morning in the bathroom. He'd used a shotgun. And just like that, I know the answer to the question I'd ask my mother. Do you think she did it on purpose? The museum docent interrupts my thoughts. "Who wants to see shrunken heads?" she asks. Emmy grabs my mother's hand and squeals, "I do, I do," and then she turns and reaches back for me. There is nothing to do but join them.
Jennifer Miller lives in Little Rock. She has an MFA from Pacific University and is currently working on a book about John Carter, the man known as Little Rock's last lynching victim. Jennifer would like to thank her friends and family, both near and far, for their love and support. In our next story, Mary Button spends the summer in Texas with her grandma Lamb, an influence that shows up years later in Grandma's Legacy.
"Muffy, come in here. I need your help," Grandma called from her bedroom. I knew what she wanted, and I dreaded going in. Getting Grandma carseted was quite an ordeal suffered only on Sundays and rent-collecting days. It was the summer I was 11, the summer I got to spend 6 weeks with Grandma Lamb. I considered it something of an adventure to go 60 miles from home to Denison, Texas, and live with my indulgent grandmother for such an extended period of time. Grandma lived a quiet life, punctuated by few outside activities. That gave rent collecting day all the more emphasis. The modest, low-rent houses she owned were scattered over several areas of the town, and Grandma went from house to house personally collecting each month's rent. She felt it important that she look her best, and she dressed accordingly. "But I don't want to look rich," I'd heard her say, "or the renters will find excuses not to pay me." Goodness knows I need every penny that's owed me. And so it was that dressing for the ritual of rent collecting was a carefully thought out process. I went in and found her half stuffed into her suit of staved armor, struggling with the laces that had to extend around the small bone hooks. If pulled tight enough, the corset would come together in the middle, but right now it lacked 3 inches meeting. Here, you pull the right one and I'll pull the left one, Grandma instructed. I did, and she did, but apparently the amount of pressure we exerted wasn't equal, so that didn't work. All right. You pull both laces and I'll breathe in and hold my breath, Grandma said next. I pulled those laces with all my 11-year-old strength, but we only gained 1/2 inch more coverage. Grandma, this corset doesn't fit. You need a new one, I ventured. Yes, it does fit, she countered. You're just not pulling tight enough. It looks old, and besides, I don't see how you can breathe when you have it on. It's not healthy. It's not that old. I may have gained a few pounds since I bought it, but it still fits. Pull harder. So I pulled harder. Another 1/2 inch covered. 2 more to go. Wait, Grandma said. She pushed flabby flesh in with one hand, pulled a lace with the other, then took both laces, and with a mighty heave and serious intake of breath, got both laces over the top bone hooks and pulled it together in the middle. There, she said with satisfaction. See, it still fits. All we had to do now was connect some hooks on the corset to some loops on the brassiere above it, and Grandma would be ready to don her outer garments. That part should have been easy, but the hot August morning made Grandma's skin clammy and damp. I continued helping her by inching her dress down and along her body. It did not readily slip or slide. When the job was completed, I passed by the dresser mirror in Grandma's bedroom and caught a glimpse of my sylph-like self. There I was, a flat-tummied, skinny kid. I vowed silently I would never wear a garment such as the tortuous one Grandma got herself into on special occasions. I would never need to. 30 years later, however, I responded to an ad of a local department store for a Playtex girdle that promised to make me appear 10 pounds thinner. When it arrived in the mail, I excitedly pulled it out of the box. The thick latex rubber was flesh-colored and frankly looked too small. Getting in and out of it was an activity best accomplished by a contortionist. But Playtex did keep its promise. Once I managed to get the rubberized garment in position and zipped, I looked in the mirror and smiled. I did look trimmer. Grandma's legacy had come full circle.
Mary Button, a transplanted Texan, came to Arkansas as a war bride and has chosen to stay in this beautiful state. She is a retired elementary school teacher. In our final story of the night, Carla Haney takes another trip with her Nana, but this one ends up quite different than the others in sartorial hell.
I opened my eyes and stretched from a long nap. We'd left early that morning from the Jiffy Mart parking lot in Hodge, Louisiana. The day was dark and misting rain. Looking out the window of the charter tour bus, I saw a lavish hotel and knew we must be in Birmingham, our first stop in the 2-week trip to Washington, D.C. I slowly looked around the large tour bus, taking in all the blue-haired women and balding men. I was the youngest person there by at least 60 years. I soon heard Mrs. Bess speaking in an antiquated southern drawl. She was a frail little woman and looked as old as Methuselah. May I have y'all's attention, please? Your keys will be issued in the lobby. All your suitcases will be delivered to your rooms, and dinner is in the East Ballroom at 6:30. Y'all get freshened up, and I'll see y'all at supper. All her ERs sounded like ahs. Nana and I made our way off the charter bus and into the lobby to collect our key. For the past 3 years, since I was 7, Nana had taken me to nearly every state in the contiguous 48. I didn't mind being with senior citizens. Our family business was owning and running a senior citizens' home. I'd gone to work with my mother every day until I went to kindergarten. I liked traveling with Nana and getting out of our little neck of the woods. Little did I know that this would be the last trip I would take with her. Walking through the opulent lobby, I saw a photo of a goblet of what looked like a strawberry icy, topped with whipped cream, and I pointed it out to her. "Nana, Nana, can I have one of those for dessert?" "No, them's for booze heads," she said, looking down at me and chuckling. I knew I couldn't have one, but I wondered why she would call someone a booze head for drinking one. She had people buy her rot gut whiskey to make her homemade cough syrup made from peppermint candies. After we had been in our room for a while, her luggage arrived, but mine didn't. "Nana, can we call Mrs. Best and see if all the luggage was taken off the bus?" She turned to me as she was getting dressed. "No, I'm sure it'll be fine. We're not going to bother anybody. You'll just have to go to supper looking like a boy in them overalls." "Thanks. I don't feel self-conscious at all now." We made it down to supper, and I saw Mr. J.R., the bus driver, sitting at a table. I made a beeline for him before Nana could stop me. "Hey, Mr. J.R.," I said, sitting down beside him. My Nana sat down beside me. "Miss Anderson, Littlen, how you doing this evening?" Mr. J.R. asked. I was quick to beat Nana because she'd just sweep it under the rug. "I'm missing my suitcase. Are you sure they were all taken off the bus? Or maybe somebody got mine by mistake?" I fiddled with my linen napkin, not looking at Nana because I knew I would be in trouble. J.R. just swallowed his iced tea and said, "I'm sure all the suitcases were taken off the bus, but you can ask Mrs. Bess if maybe somebody else got yours," he said sympathetically. "It sure would be awful to go 2 weeks with one suit of clothes." I played with the food on my plate. "I know. If they don't find my clothes, do you think maybe you could take me to a mall or something so I could get some new..." "Carla," my grandmother admonished as she pulled me toward her by my arm. Then, in a mock sweet voice, she said, "It ain't nice to ask people for favors like that. JR can't go traipsing around this big city looking for clothes for you. You'll just have to make do with what you got." I could feel the tears beginning to burn my eyes, and I believe Mr. J.R. could see the anguish on my face. "Hun, if we don't find your clothes, I'll make sure we get you some new ones," he said. His tone was gentle and soothing. When we were leaving supper, we saw Mike, who unloaded the car that morning. Nana asked him, and he said, "No, Miss Anderson, I saw 3 suitcases, yours, mine, and brother and sister Spell's. There it was. My suitcase was in the trunk of Nana's car in Louisiana, filled with brand new clothes." That night, Nana put on her nightgown and satin bonnet with hair clamps. She handed me one of her nightgowns and said, "You'll just have to wear this and wash your drawers out in the sink, then set them on the air conditioner to dry." Sullenly, I did, and put on the gown that was large enough for about 3 of me. I gave her my patented eye roll and whined, "But Nana, I don't want to wear the same underwear for 2 days in a row. That's just gross." "Well, Miss Curacy, you're just going to have to. They're fine. They've been washed with soap and hot water," she said, leaning over her makeup case to get out of her cold cream. She pronounced curious as though it rhymed with hearse, and she didn't mean I had an inquiring mind. She meant I was peculiar. The next day, Mr. J.R. drove us to a mall in Birmingham. We went to a department store and found a section for little girls. They had some sundresses, shorts, and t-shirts, and other things. I saw a lot of things I like, and I chose several items while Nana just looked around. "Nana, I found some things I like. We just need to get some panties and a gown. Then I'll be ready," I said. Nana looked at the items I had in my hand and shook her head. "Do you think I'm made of money? I'm buying one outfit. Your mama bought you a suitcase full of clothes before you left, and you're not going to pick out something that makes you look like a boy. Here, this is real pretty." She picked up a green polyblend elastic waist skirt and a gold polyester satin-like shirt. Mini senior citizen attire. Sartorial hell. "This is what you're getting," she said. "There's a saying I've heard used only by my family regarding the rich. So-and-so has enough money to burn a wet dog." I've never understood it, but I know the saying would apply to Nana. She always talked as though she was one step away from the poorhouse, but she could have well afforded to purchase more than one outfit. She simply chose not to. Nana continued, "Now let's see about some drawers. What size do you wear?" I was in shock, but I knew better than to cry, so I just answered her, "I don't know. Mom always buys them." I looked at the packages of floral cotton underwear, just wanting this experience to be over. "Well, you're 10 years old, so you probably wear a size 10. She picked up a package of 3 and walked to the register. "What about something for me to wear to sleep?" I asked, turning to a rack of gowns and shorty pajamas. Nana just hurrumped. "You don't need none of those. You can wear one of my gowns like you did last night." Afterward, we went back to the bus where Mr. J.R. was waiting, and he drove us back to the hotel. In the elevator, I gripped the bag holding my meager purchases and swayed side to side anxiously. Finally, the elevator dinged, announcing our floor. Heck, I didn't have a new wardrobe, but I did have clean pants. I raced to the room, tore the package open, and undressed. Pulled out the first flower pair. I thought they might be bikinis. My heart plummeted as I yanked them up to my knees. I pulled and I tugged until I heard the sickening rip of fabric. That was it. Those panties were a no-go. Much to my dismay, I did have to wash my underwear every night for the entire trip. And I was forced to look like a mini grandmother on the days I didn't wear my overalls. As for the trips with Nana, we'd had a heap of fun, and I loved her very much. But after that excursion, vacations with my mother and sister were far more appealing. Moreover, truth be told, I just couldn't be put through any more sartorial hell.
Carla Haney grew up in Bear Creek, Louisiana, and was extremely close to her maternal grandmother as a child. She now lives in Little Rock, Arkansas, with her husband and 2 children. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.